At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/real ID or visit your local DMV.
Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. Here are your hosts, your ghost hosts, Jason and Dee.
Hello, boils and ghouls. Welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. To my left, I have Dee Graves, who is covered in cockroaches. I, of course, am covered with weeds, and I'm very itchy. And we're welcoming back Amanda Janik with her head on a platter to discuss Creepshow and Twilight Zone, the movie, in this wonderful, scary, spooky season of Halloween.
We are here on October 2nd, 2024. Exactly 65 years to the day from the day that the Twilight Zone series first aired on television. To the day.
Wow.
Amanda, how you doing? Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm great. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Amanda, you're like the scary movie queen, right? You're the one who's going to carry us through this episode.
No, that's your guys' job. I'm just here for fun.
You do like horror movies a lot though, right?
I do, but very niche horror movies, though. You know, I'm not into the paranormal, that kind of stuff. I'm more 80s kind of slasher, cheesy slasher in the woods type of movie. But these two are right up my alley as well. So
are you a King person?
I wouldn't say I'm fanatical by any means. I read all the books when I was younger and stuff, and obviously saw the movies. Christine is still one of my favorites to this day. Fright Fest on AMC every year. Love Christine. Carrie, absolutely love it. More the movies than the books, I would say. I don't have the attention span for 2,000-page books.
You know, this time last year, Dee, you and I did Christine versus Cujo versus The Dead Zone.
Yeah.
All Stephen King movies that came out in 1983.
Yep. And these movies are close to being 40 years old.
So Creepshow was released November 12th, 1982, and Twilight Zone was released June 24th, 1983, I believe.
Okay. All right. So 41 and 42, respectively.
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. You guys know what happened on Christmas Day exactly 100 years ago? Rod Serling was born.
Sunnyvale Rest, a home for the aged. A dying place and a common children's game called Kick the Can.
I love this. I was reading about his childhood. He was raised by kind of, you know, blue collar family. His dad worked as a grocer and then a butcher, but built him a stage downstairs because he could just make his own plays with or without an audience. Said that his family said that they got in the car one time and he just had this tendency to just talk and ask questions without waiting for an answer and just keep going. And so they all decided before they got in the car for this cross-country trip that they weren't going to say anything and see if Rod would notice. He did not notice.
Wow.
And so he was an interesting guy. I mean, he's got these, you know, plays in his head from being a little kid. And then he goes to war. He serves in World War II, was with a guy who was like doing a stand-up routine for the troops, like another fellow soldier. They had like a crate of food was dropped for them and it landed on the guy doing the stand-up routine and decapitated him.
What?
He said that like his war experience highly influenced how he wrote things. And so once he got back, he went to college. He started doing stuff in radio, ultimately started writing TV pilots because he figured radio was going out and it was the perfect time for somebody to be writing TV plays.
Yeah.
And so he wrote this play called Patterns. Okay. It's a teleplay and they actually performed it live, but he had just moved to New York City. He wasn't expecting it to be anything big. And they found a babysitter that night. And she said, what if somebody calls? And they said, don't worry. We literally just moved here. Nobody's going to call. You'll be fine. Well, that was the first time his play was on TV, and it was so amazingly popular that the phone had 100 phone calls before they got back that night.
Wow.
It's the first television play to ever be replayed. They replayed it live, and then they made it into a movie. Then he had another success with a movie called Requiem for a Heavyweight. Another success was 7 Days in May, and they realized, hey, this guy's got something going. And so they give him the opportunity to do a, how do we say this? Something of his own, because he had gotten tired of the TV censors and the sponsors curbing what work he put out there. They were changing his writing to make it TV suitable. And so he said, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be in charge of my own show. And that's how we got The Twilight Zone, October 2nd, 1959.
Wow. Wow. Amanda, what's your experience with The Twilight Zone? Did you watch that as a kid or anything?
No, I don't remember seeing it when I was like super young, but I think it probably stemmed from Creepshow, to be honest, because I remember seeing that when I was pretty young, probably too young.
Right.
And then I fell in love with the anthology idea. So I think that's probably how I stumbled upon Twilight Zone. And as a young kid, let's say maybe I was 8 or 9 maybe when I saw it. Don't judge my parents. Twilight Zone was way over my head at that age. So I don't think I revisited it a lot.
Right.
You know, not nearly as much as I did Creepshow. It wasn't until I got older that I started to understand more of the concepts that were actually in Twilight Zone and could appreciate it more.
What about you?
Well, I had watched the TV series growing up. Like, uh-huh. I remember watching it on like Nick at Night and some of the other stuff that would have the old shows mm-hmm. on. And so I was excited when the movie came out. And I was young too. I mean, in, what did we say, it was 83.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have been 7 or 8 years old. And I can remember, I mean, it's a PG movie. So my parents let me watch it before PG-13 was a thing.
Hey, PG must be okay for everybody.
Yeah. And so some of those things were particularly disturbing, especially the prologue scene.
Oh, the prologue scene, gotcha.
Yeah, got a big old jump scare.
I was a kid, and I was raised, my dad raised me on all kinds of music. I think we might have talked about this in past episodes and stuff. And like, by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I was a huge CCR fan. So remember the prologue.
Right.
Now with Creepshow, I had the comic book that they made from the movie. You know, they had like a comic novel, and I same place that I would go buy my Fangoria magazine.
Right, right.
There was an episode, there was a, you know, comic book of Creepshow out there, and I was like, oh, this looks cool. I'm going to get this. And I got it. I didn't even know about the movie. Like, I was young enough when that movie came out that it kind of went by me, and I didn't know about it until years later. And then I was like, probably Blockbuster or one of its, you know, some video store. And I'm like, oh, hey, I had that comic book. And by that time I was old enough that I was like, okay, I can watch this movie. How about you? What about Twilight Zone and Creepshow for you?
Yeah. So when I was growing up in Tulsa, we got a TV station out of Kansas City. On Friday nights, they would show like reruns of Get Smart, The Three Stooges, The Twilight Zone, and then they'd show like a creature feature, like Bride of Frankenstein or whatever. So every Friday night, man, there I am. I'm taking in Get Smart, Twilight Zone, Three Stooges, and whatever monster movie. The one Twilight Zone that haunts me to this day, there's a bank robber and he gets shot during a bank robbery. And when he wakes up, like, he's like rich and like all these beautiful women are throwing themselves at him and like everything is like awesome. He's like, man, how did this happen? I was a bank robber and here I am and everything's going my way. And it turns out like every time he takes one pool shot, like every ball goes in every pocket. And it's like his punishment is that there's no challenge ever in his life ever again. Like everything is over the top good. And it, as a kid, I was like, whoa, like hell is every time you pull the lever at the casino, millions of dollars spills out and just everything goes your way.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
I can remember seeing people like Robert Redford in one of them where he's in his 20s.
He's young. Yeah.
He's just this very handsome young man who, as you know, as it turns out, it's this little old lady who won't like go out of her. It's very similar to on Creepshow, the E.G. Marshall episode,
Creeping Up on You.
Yeah, where she's like, she's contained herself in this little space and won't go out because she's too scared that death is going to get her when she goes out. And then this young police officer played by Robert Redford gets shot and he's like dying on her doorstep. And she's like, okay, I'm just going to bring you in. But I got to bring you in quick and I have to take care of you here. And like, she mends him back to health and he ultimately is, you know, very thankful. And then he says, I'm here for you.
Yeah. He's the angel of death. Yeah. I remember that one.
I love the way that those Twilight Zones would twist it. By the way, I had no idea until I started investigating. one of the best movie twists of all time, Planet of the Apes. Get to the end of Planet of the Apes, you see the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
I'm like, whoa, fantastic. Found out today Rod Serling was co-writer on Planet of the Apes.
All right. That's awesome.
Interesting. You know, it's Jason, it's funny. You just unlocked a key memory for me, though, because I was, you know, when you asked me that question, I was thinking more about Twilight Zone, the movie. Not necessarily the show, but on Friday nights, we used to get, because I grew up in outside of Chicago, so we'd get all the Chicago stations, and then my grandma lived in Milwaukee, so, you know, it was either we were in Chicago or in Milwaukee on Friday night, and it was always Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock, and Ray Bradbury Theater.
Ooh, nice.
And then for that brief year or whatever, the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Oh, wow.
It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. But that's more what I was into. Like, it was more like I'd sit through, like, you know, Twilight Zone, Ray Bradbury, and be like, okay. Because, again, over my head at that age, you know. So that's funny, though. I totally forgot about that.
That's fun. That's fun. So, Dee, you mentioned a decapitation just a minute ago.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, that will not be the last decapitation that we talk about in this episode. But
it won't even be the second to last.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to hold that, though. Let's talk about that here in a little while.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So other fans of the TV show, The Twilight Zone, were some guys named John Landis, George Miller, Joe Dante, and Steven Spielberg.
Sure.
And so after the show had been off the air, I think it went off the air in something like 65. So it had been off the air for almost 20 years, and they said, let's make a movie. And so those four directors all direct a segment. Of the four, three of them are their remakes of actual Twilight Zone, original Twilight Zone episodes. And some of the actors from those original episodes are in the new episodes in the movie.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know why they did that? Why they did three out of the four of them remakes of the original show? It was to make it more marketable. To bring in that old audience and then bring in the new audience as well, but put different spins on them. You know, I mean, some of them don't obviously follow the original show, what happened in there or whatever, but they thought, hey, we'll get that nostalgia for those people who grew up with this show and just make it more marketable. And I'm glad they didn't keep them exactly the same, because if I wanted to see that, I would just go watch the episode.
That's right. That's right.
Why am I going to watch John Lithgow when I can watch The Shat?
Because he's the Trinity Killer. That's why you watched John.
Okay. So I thought that as far back as I was going to go was 100 years ago. With the birth of Rod Serling, but it turns out I'm going to go back 130 years ago, almost exactly again. It's September 21st, 1894. This guy named Max Gaines is born. When he's in his late 30s, he pioneers a new type of book. He was trying to do some marketing for Procter & Gamble for a newspaper he was working for. And he was like, hey, what we're going to do is we're going to take all of the little comic strips from the newspapers, and we're going to put them all in like this big book, like this tabloid sized book. And then people will send in your, you know, Procter & Gamble proof of purchase, and they get a free book. And Procter & Gamble was like, that sounds like a terrible idea. We're not interested. And so he was like, hey, newspaper publisher, can we do this thing anyway? And they did it anyway. And what it was the precursor to the comic book. This guy, Max Gaines, is the guy who basically invents the comic book. All right.
Wow.
He becomes later on after that, the co-publisher of All American Publications, who introduced us to some folks you might've heard of: Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Wonder Woman.
Wow.
The first superheroes. Obviously, All American Publications became DC, but later on he would die, and I'll go into that in just a second. So he ends up selling his share of All American and starts his own comic book line called Educational Comics, EC. Okay.
Okay. Interesting.
And so Educational Comics, he's putting out like the Bible in comic book form, and he's putting out these other educational type of comics in addition to some of the superhero stuff. But then he dies tragically, his son takes over, and his son is like, heck with this educational thing, I'm going to change it to Entertainment Comics. Now, it may sound like that the son is a bit of a ne'er-do-well and the father was kind of had his dreams annihilated after his death. But as it turns out, Max Gaines was kind of the Bing Crosby of the comic book world, where everybody was like, oh, hey, here's this great guy who invented comic books, except he would beat his son with a belt and tell him, you will never amount to anything. And so when he and a few friends died in a boating accident, suddenly Billy, little young Billy, who's in his 20s at that point.
Call me Billy, everybody else.
Billy says. Gaines. And if you know who William Gaines is, if you're a comic book fan, you're gonna be like, whoa. And if not, I'm about to tell you. Because it turns out that Max was a bastard. He was a bastard. And Bill was excited to take the comic book empire and take it in a new direction. And so he changed it from educational comics to entertainment comics. And he gave us some titles you might have heard of. Weird Science.
What?
Tales from the Crypt.
Whoa!
And Mad Comic Books, which ultimately became Mad Magazine.
That is amazing.
Now, these comic books, they gained some attention because of their kind of graphic nature. And he had to go testify in front of Congress about these comic books. And they're asking, they're like, do you feel like anything is appropriate, you know, that's for you to put in these comic books? And he's like, well, anything within good taste. And they're like, but you decide what good taste is. And he's like, yeah.
Yep. You
and
got
they,
it.
And they say, how about this comic book right here, where you have a man with an axe with blood running down the handle. And in his other hand, he has what appears to be the head of another human being. And it appears that there's a body lying on the floor. Would you say that that is in good taste? And he's like, oh yeah. I mean, cause you can't see the neck. If you saw the neck, that probably would be in bad taste. Or if you saw the body and saw where the head wasn't attached anymore, that might be in bad taste. But since those things are out, we're all good.
Uh-huh.
So these EC comics, including the Tales from the Crypt and the Weird Science and Mad Magazine, these EC comics were the inspiration for Stephen King and George Romero to make the movie Creepshow.
Originally, it was born from Salem's Lot, too. Did you read about that? So originally, George Romero was shopping his movie Martin around different film festivals and whatnot. And the studio Warner Brothers saw it and thought, hey, you know, this would be a great collaboration with George Romero, because you got to think he's hot, hot, hot at that point, you know. Or Stephen King is super hot at that time too. And so they thought these two together would be really good. Would you guys be interested in doing Salem's Lot together? But then distributor decided to just do Salem's Lot as a TV release. Right. So then they started shopping around again for another project, and they were looking at The Stand.
Yes.
But the budget for that would have been way too big. So again, the studio passed on that. And so eventually King and Romero just came together on their own and said, hey, we both like, he had just explained, love comic books. What if we do a movie like that? We can do it cheaper and it'll appeal to a mass audience. It's an anthology. Let's do this thing. So okay, I just think it's interesting that came from Salem's Lot.
It is. Yeah. It is. And we talked about Salem's Lot last year when we did our horror movies of the 70s.
That's right.
Get this. So George Romero is super famous because he created the Night of the Living Dead movie. Get this. So he does Martin in 1977 about a man who thinks he's a vampire, but he had been out of film for a couple of years. He did a TV movie on O.J. Simpson.
Juice is on the loose.
Did you get that? The juice is loose. The good old-fashioned heroic story of O.J. Simpson.
Well, it was a thing back in 1974.
Yeah. 1974.
In a mere 20 years later, he would be driving down the highway in a white Bronco.
He does Dawn of the Dead in 1978, and he does Knight Riders in 1981. Do you know why I bring up Knight Riders?
No, I don't.
Because it stars Mr. Ed Harris, who's going to participate in Creepshow as a favor to George Romero because of their relationship from Knight Riders.
Okay, so that Knight Riders, you're talking about that terrible biker movie, right?
I'm not talking about Michael and Kit. Yeah.
That's what I thought you were talking about. I was like, you're talking about, you were confusing people here. We're not talking about the Hoff.
Knight Riders.
Knight Riders, which I think I saw some of that, and it was like, it was a combination of medieval knights, except they were riding on motorcycles, like a motorcycle. Yeah.
You got it.
It was a colossal piece of crap. Yeah, really, really bad.
That sounds terrible. You know, and the guy, Tom Savini, makeup god, did all the work on Dawn of the Dead. So that's why they brought him in for Creepshow.
Yeah.
And he's you know a fun little cameo in there, too. So that was
does.
Fun.
Yeah, he's one of the garbage men at the very end who picks up the comic book. Yeah.
He's the garbage man that when I watched it for the first time, I'm like, what's this guy's problem? He's way over the top for this movie. By the way, I've got this little nugget for you. Romero and King wanted to do each part of the anthology as like a history of the movies, right? So like the first segment was going to be black and white. And then the next one was going to be like narrow screen. And then the third one was going to be like in 3D. And I thought, wow, that would be really cool, right? very interesting.
I would
stylistically.
Actually, I was going to say I would actually have appreciated some stylistic change in this one. Yeah, it came out as full comic book to me. Like the colors were bright. Obviously, they used the comic book transitions. They used it heavily. But even the lighting and the color grading was very. It was very comic booky.
It was comic booky. And even like they had reaction shots where the ladies were like, ah, and there's like a comic book thing behind them.
See, that's the beauty of it. That's what I think is the beauty of the movie.
Those parts were interesting. When you would have the screams and it was really like a cardboard cutout behind them and the flashing light.
When we talk about segments, I'll talk about my favorite cartoony part of that movie. The part that just stands out to me is the best shot of the movie, but we'll get there.
Amanda, just to kind of go with you on your point, I would love to see a King Romero collaboration, Salem's Lot or The Stand. That would be amazing.
Well, that new Salem's Lot's coming out on Max.
Yes.
Maybe a week or two from now.
Can't wait.
It looks good.
It looks great. Finally.
And that's not normally my kind of thing, but I was watching the preview. I'm like, oh, I might have to watch that. So,
yeah.
And from what I understand, it has King's blessing. So not a lot of projects do. So it'll be interesting to see.
Interesting. Okay.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Okay, Jason, we have got a huge catalog of actors, most of whom it was before they were famous, right? Or maybe after they were famous, before they were famous again.
You know, there's a hodgepodge of people that you recognize in Creepshow, right? Yep. So one of them in the first segment is called Father's Day.
Huh?
And that stars.
Wait a minute. Today?
Yes.
You know what tomorrow is?
Father's Day.
It's October 3rd.
Yes.
Does that mean anything to you?
No.
What kind of friend are you?
I'm sorry. She was like, it was like a national holiday. It's Dee's birthday tomorrow.
Where's my cake, you
29 years young again. How exciting. Happy early birthday.
Hey, I've been a father for over 20 years now.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever gotten a cake on Father's Day?
You actually asked me about getting a cake for this particular birthday. It's one birthday. You're like, do you want a cake? And I'm like, no, please do not give me a cake. I'm a little worried I'm going to get a severed head with candles in it.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thanks. Thank you.
I was like trying to rack my brain. Like, what national holiday is tomorrow? Oh, it's Dee's birthday. Okay, so the first segment of Creepshow is the tale called Father's Day. Okay, now in this one you have Ed Harris,
Ed freaking from Oklahoma Harris,
Boomer Sooner.
Although he did drop the program because they were like, "Yeah, you're not really that great an actor." He's like, "I'll see you guys later."
Yeah, what's the story with that? Because you were in the theater program. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of urban legend around Ed Harris in the theater department at the University of Oklahoma, especially for people who were rejected when it came time for juries, which is how you decided if you're going to get to go be a performance major or not. The rumor was that he failed his juries; they weren't going to let him be a performance major, and he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll just go to New York City and do it on my own, or maybe Chicago." But I don't know that any of that's actually true. It's all just the rumor mill of the OU drama department.
Wow.
But I do know that he did not finish college at OU, and he did go on to be obviously a very famous actor.
Yes. Yes, he did. Okay. So
time out for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want to talk about the casting and the wraparound for Creepshow, though?
Good point, Amanda. Let's talk about the prologue for Creepshow, mm-hmm. because you start off with a very famous guy.
Yes.
A very famous kid. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
We got the God himself, Tom Atkins, whom I often joke with my husband that I'm on the Tom Atkins diet. So he is pre-stash, you guys. I still, every time I watch the movie, cannot get over him without a mustache. Totally cracks me up. What a mean SOB he is in that prologue. He is just an absolutely awful person. And I couldn't help think, but when you were talking about the EC Comics thing, when you call him a bastard, I'm like, dude, like there might've been a little inspo right there.
Exactly.
I think you're right.
Exactly what I was thinking.
And Tom Atkins' character right there. But then the little boy is played by Stephen King's own son, Joe Hill.
That's right.
He looked familiar.
Who looks just like him.
World famous author himself, right?
Right.
And Stephen King's son.
If I'm not mistaken, he does a lot of work on that Creepshow itself that's on Shudder. I think he's heavily involved with that. So he kind of took over and that's the pseudonym he writes under. I can't remember his actual first name, but he's written books and stuff too. So he's pretty entrenched in the entertainment industry himself. But I think he started going by Joe Hill just so he wouldn't be accused of
nepotism.
Thank you. But when he actually slaps him in that scene too, it was the makeup and stuff. And his dad took him to the store, and the lady, the checkout lady at the store, actually called the cops.
That's right.
He thought that he was abusing his son. So they had to explain it was makeup work and stuff. So yeah, good work on the part of the makeup department on the movie for making it look that realistic.
That's fantastic.
By the way, Tom Atkins.
Thrill me.
Thrill me, right? Night of the Creeps, Halloween, the Season of the Witch.
Yep.
Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon.
Shot through a carton of milk.
That's right. Michael Hunsaker.
Only movie he's not playing a stud.
So, yes. Prologue's great. Before I watched the movie, I was like, I know with Twilight Zone, we've got a prologue that gets a button at the end. And Jason was like, yeah, we've got it on Creepshow too. So the kid's reading the comic book. And then, of course, like this death zombie looking thing, I noticed, I'm like, man, I'm seeing episode by episode as we're going through, and George Romero is directing all of these, and every single one of them has some undead being in it. Eventually he stops doing that. There's no undead in some of them, but you get that undead guy, and then you get this cool transition into the cartoon
slash right.
comic. And that's when you get the introductory credits, and then we move into Father's Day.
Right, because we get the Crypt Keeper. Well, he's not called the Crypt Keeper. He was called the Crypt Keeper in Tales from the Crypt, but the skeleton. And it's funny because that was actually constructed from a real skeleton, a real human skeleton that they dressed up and stuff because it was cheaper than buying a prop. So it was shipped from India.
Wow.
Say what?
Yeah.
Wow.
All right.
Okay. That's stunning right there. Okay, so also in Father's Day, I want to point out Vivica Lindforce. She plays Aunt Bedelia, I believe. She is a famous, like, classical actress. Uh-huh. She starred in a movie in 1949, Night Unto Night. You know why that's interesting? Because her co-star was Mr. Ronald Reagan.
Oh.
The actor.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's his vice president. Jerry Lewis. Good job. Nice nugget. I like
Thank
that.
I gotta look up a picture of this now.
And she was very pretty. And even though she's super kind of old and haggard and Creepshow, but very beautiful. And
well,
then
she was a drunk. So let's give her a little credit.
I wanted to point out this other lady who's in it, Elizabeth Regan. She's Ed Harris's dancing partner.
His wife.
Yes. I guess.
Yeah.
This is basically the only thing she ever does. Like there's almost nothing else that she does.
Okay.
Like somebody buried her in sand and we never see her again.
I actually took note this time when I was watching it to prepare. I don't think she's that bad of an actress. Like when she's begging her brother to go out and look for her husband, it looks very genuine. So if that's right. The only thing she ever did, that's interesting.
What do you guys think about this segment of Father's Day?
Richard, I'm scared and it's dark out there.
Look, I just want to get another bottle of wine, okay?
Please, Richard.
All right. Come on. Come on.
I love it. And in doing research, it seems almost like I might be a little bit the minority on that one. But I love it. I just think it's great. I think that the creature effects are fascinating. How dumb Ed Harris is dancing. How he's just laying there with a headstone coming down. He doesn't even try to move. The head on a platter. I just think the whole thing's great. I love the makeup effects, the creature design. I love the whole thing. So, I think it's just a really interesting story, too.
So do you love the camp? Like, on campy movies, do you love the camp?
If done correctly, yeah.
Okay. Because
yeah,
to me,
not
like,
always.
I'm in the majority here. I'm just like, this is ridiculous. This whole thing is ridiculous. But I will say this. I will say when the hand comes up out of the ground, mm-hmm. that was a good jump scare for me. I was like, oh, okay. Dang, it's a nice one. Good one. All right.
Yeah.
But
it was the Jack Daniels that did it that brought him back.
Right. Yeah, right. No, I don't get it. I don't know what the point of the story is. It's like she killed him and he killed her back and then killed the kids too.
The fact that Ed Harris lays on his back while that stone is moving.
Because he's got no choice.
Dude, get up.
He gets up and faces the demon from hell or he hopes that the thing doesn't fall.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, no, I was in your same boat.
But
actually.
See, I was
just
you
like,
go,
roll over.
You have
just
to
roll over three.
The
feet.
Mindset though that these are based on comic books. Like in comic books are ridiculous.
Father's Day. I got my cake.
Oh my God!
Happy Father's Day.
If they had tried to make this all serious, it wouldn't be a comic book movie. Then why call it Creepshow? Why say it's based on comic books? Like, it's a different kind of movie.
Listen, I want to be completely transparent here. I had to hurry to get this movie done. So I watched it on my phone at 1.5 speed. Like, I'm watching it get sped up. And even sped up, I'm still going, Ed Harris, what are you doing? You have all of the time in the world. Go.
That is funny. That is funny. I agree.
By the way, there is a cool prop in this segment that is reused later. You know about this?
Yep.
Every segment,
the ashtray that she beats his head in with. It appears on every single segment plus.
Wow. I didn't know.
The ashtray that she kills him with. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, that's great.
I like that. Okay. We done with that one?
Yep.
Let's talk about The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, starring Mr. Stephen King himself.
Oh, Jordy Verrill, you lunkhead.
I found that interesting as a kid. I was like, oh my gosh, that is Stephen King, the guy who has written all these unbelievable stories.
And what a fantastic actor he is, too.
You're being facetious right now, I can tell. The listeners can't see your face right now.
I'm getting the side eye from Janik over there.
Let me tell you about his face right now. He is not serious.
Okay, so the name of this one is the Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill.
Yep.
There is a Bob Dylan song called The Lonesome Death of Patty Carroll.
Interesting.
I think it has to be taken from that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Just FYI, Patty Carroll, Bob Dylan wrote a song about her. She was a lady who was killed in 1963, African-American lady who was killed by the rich son of a tobacco farmer, and he got 6 months in jail and was released. It was at the time of segregation. It was at the time of, he wasn't even tried by a jury. It was a 3-judge panel and they gave him 6 months for assault. And that was it. Bob Dylan writes a song called The Lonesome Death of Patty Carroll. And then Stephen King writes a story in the 70s.
So this appeared in Gallery Magazine, which is about 10 notches down from Playboy, you know?
It makes Hustler look like Time Magazine.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it was the way that we get Stephen King movies into the world.
Hey, he was a beginning writer doing his best to feed his family. Whoever's willing to pay money for your story, take the money and run.
But I do think it's interesting. So George Romero talks Stephen King into playing this part. Stephen King's like, dude, I'm writing the story. I'm busy. I'm working on Christine. I'm trying to finish Christine. And he's like, no, you got to play this part. And so when he brought him in to play it, he said, I want you to play it just like Wile E. Coyote.
Yep. I have the exact quote because I think it's so interesting. He said, I don't think Steve to this day has forgiven me because my only direction to him was play it like the Roadrunner in the Warner Brothers cartoons. Just go way out into left field with it and exaggerate as much as you want to, he recalled. And of course, critics came back and said, well, this is not a very subtle performance and it's not supposed to be. I mean, it's supposed to be a cartoon. It is basically a cartoon. So again, Dee, it is a cartoon. It is a comic. It is, you know, it's meant to be that way.
Sure.
Okay. And I would argue, I'm going to push back on this just a little bit. If this is played serious, like a meteor from outer space comes and you get an infection on your body where plants are taking over your body and you cannot get wet or else, and you're covered with this itch. It's this great rub of, I have to shower. I can't shower. I think it's super tense. It could be super scary, and it's still scary, but it's really goofy.
I don't think it's scary at all. I don't think that was even the intention.
Don't you think it could be played scary though?
You know, I think like if you think back to like, you know, 50s and 60s B movies, you know, the infestation of the giant ants and the radioactive whatever, like I think that's more what it was meant to be, where it's like, okay, imagine this worst case scenario, but the people are going to make the worst decisions they possibly can make, you know, and that's why they made him a dumb character. To your point, if they had played it more serious, made him a smarter guy or whatever. Are you really scared that plants are going to take over the world? I mean, really scared. We all saw The Happening. Like, was that scary? No. You know? So right. I think they played it with the right angle. I will say it's my least favorite segment out of all of them.
Really? Wow. Yeah. I like this one.
I mean, yeah.
Once I like it because at the end, it really does come to a head and he blows his brains out, you know?
Well, mm-hmm. I just can't support it. So the first story is this old lady is coming back for Father's Day, the day that she killed her father, and her father comes out of the grave and kills her. That's the end of the story.
Yes, you got it.
This story is a guy sees a meteor, he touches it, he gets grass on him, it gets to grow over his whole body so much that he decides to blow his brains out.
He's itchy.
That's the beginning of a story. That's not the whole story. There's nothing.
What's left to the imagination, though? Because at the end, they talk about record level rainfalls and, you know, so it's like, how many meteors actually fell? You know, did it happen all over the town? Did it happen all over the country, all over the world, whatever? Is this the end of the world as we know it?
I don't think it's even the meteors. I think that it lays it out for us that the weeds are taking over. We're 188 miles from Boston, mm-hmm. and there's a big rain coming. And so mm-hmm. it is the end of the world, mm-hmm. which I thought was a really cool transition.
5 miles. From Castle Rock, part of King's Dominion.
There you go.
Apparently it didn't because we have Cujo next year. So
there you go. Okay. What's next on our creep show timeline?
All right. The very next one is called Something to Tide You Over. This stars a pre-Cheers Ted Danson and a pre-Police Squad Leslie Nielsen.
Richard, get it out of here.
He's just getting revenge, Harry, for all the relatives of his that you ate. Baked and stuffed at my maison. Bad fellow, you. Oh, bad fellow.
Yeah.
Pre-Naked Gun. And that's basically it. You've got a girl in there somewhat, but it's basically these two guys
yep.
who square off. This is my favorite one. This is my absolute favorite.
I love it.
Yeah.
The storyline on this is much better.
Okay.
It's still not what I would call good, but it is much better.
Do you feel the hate coming?
I don't think we even have to do final judgment. I'm just guessing.
I told you this is going to be more like Braveheart and Gladiator.
Okay.
Me.
All right.
I'm not just going to ball out hate it, but there is a little bit more to the story in this one. You know, they come back and they do it to him. But again, I'm just like, I don't know. I wanted something more. I think you want a full feature. We're going to talk about the stories in Twilight Zone here in a minute.
Yeah.
And I will be able to tell you what was achieved there that was not achieved here.
Okay. So let's just talk about what happens in this one. So you got this guy named Richard Vickers, who's played by Leslie Nielsen, who's rich, powerful, jealous.
Yep.
And Ted Danson has taken his wife. And so Richard's like, nobody takes anything from me, mister.
Right. One of the things that I love about Stephen King is the way that he comes up with character names. The guy's name is Richard Vickers, and he's a rich guy. Like, that's great. Yeah. I love he's so good at naming these characters. In every book that I've read of his, the characters always have fantastic names.
So he comes to Ted Danson and he plays a little recorded clip, and it's Becky who is like, oh my gosh, he's got me. Come get me. Oh, help me. And he's like, oh, what'd you do to her? I'm going to kill you. And he's like, oh, kill me. And you'll never find out where, you know, it's the classic trap of you've got to come with me to find out where she is. And they get in the car and they take Leslie Nielsen's awesome Jeep out to the beach.
It is awesome.
It is awesome, right?
You can't skip over the fact in this segment, though, that when Leslie Nielsen shows up, it's one of my favorite things about the movies. Or about the movie, that Ted Danson is in a robe and Leslie Nielsen gives him time to change into a multi-layered corduroy outfit before they leave. I think it's hilarious thinking about him sitting in the living room like, you ready yet? Ready?
Ted Danson also threatens him at the very beginning. He's like, move your foot, buddy. I bench press 300 pounds. I'm like, no, you don't. That is a lie.
Right. Good stuff.
Mayday Malone does not bench 300 pounds. So they drag him out to the beach. Leslie Nielsen pulls a gun on him, tells him to get in the hole. There's like a giant hole built in the beach. And so Ted Danson's like, no way, I'm not doing it. And he fires a bullet. So that's the question you have to ask yourself. Would I take the bullet or would I take my chances in the hole?
Oh, yeah. I totally run and straight at the guy. There's no way you don't see what's coming in this scenario.
I would take my chances with the sand. I feel like I could wiggle my way out of sand.
Ooh, your kids have never buried you in sand, have they?
I might be wrong, but yeah,
if especially wet sand, that's concrete.
No, sir.
Yes, but
unless you happen to bench 300 pounds. Right. So Ted Danson should have gotten out.
I'm giving the 10-foot running start at Leslie Nielsen. I'm betting he can hit you from there with a gun.
I know, but I might be able to take him down after he hits me. I'm not going to incapacitate myself voluntarily.
Yeah, not a chance.
He also lies to him and says, if you'll do this, I just want to incapacitate you and I'll tell you where she is.
I thought she's, you know, he said, I'll let you see her.
I'll let you see her.
He doesn't lie.
He never lies.
Yeah.
So he does incapacitate him. And he does show her to him through the wonderful technology of VCR on the beach.
I love with endless cord. With endless cord. In the Jeep, there's like a 5-mile cord that he's got rolling out of the back. Just in case you were like, how do you get power on the beach? Well, we rolled it in, sir. We have cables on a spool.
Right. By the way, Ted Danson had just shot the pilot for this TV show. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Nope.
It's called Cheers.
Oh, was he in that?
How about that? Making so cool. But I love that story.
Wesley Nielsen lifting up the old Fox TV like it's nothing, like it's a TV nowadays. That thing had to weigh 150 pounds.
No doubt.
It was a 2-people job to move the TV around in the living room.
Yep. I remember that. Yep.
Well, maybe he benches 300 pounds too.
And then, well, he shows Ted Danson that Becky, you know, was in the hole as well. And the tide was coming in and she had to fight to keep from drowning.
Live feed. That VCR back there is on record, not play.
and then he asked him, you know, how long can you hold your breath? That to me is super tense. I love this story. I think it's great.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, it's better. Yeah, it's better.
Okay. Did you get the heebie-jeebies when they just kept showing his head though? Like I felt like claustrophobic because I started thinking about that because I have been buried in sand at the beach, you know, playfully, obviously. And right. It's like, you can't move. It's like concrete. So it's like, especially if you're vertical like that and he had a kneel. And uh-huh. He was right. You have no leverage. Your arms are down at your side. You're not getting out of there. Like, so yeah. I was literally like getting a little claustrophobic just sitting there watching that.
I will tell you that the effect that they did where his head is completely under the water and he's gasping for breath, that was intense. That was a great shot. That was an intense shot. You're wondering what's going to happen. How is he going to get out of this? And then it cuts away to Leslie Nielsen watching it on his, you know, on his cameras at the house, comes back and Leslie Nielsen is like, well, he must have washed away with the tide because he can't find the body.
What I had mentioned earlier about the best shot in the movie.
Yeah.
That's my favorite shot when it's backlit comic book style. Okay. Yeah. But it's backlit in his hair and the way the bubbles are going up the way they're supposed to and everything. Like, how did they do that? I don't know. Jason talked about it actually.
He said that they had an aquarium, put him in a wetsuit, and like somebody would hand him a breather and he'd breathe it.
Because we're pre-CGI, we're pre, like,
he was in the water.
Very cool shot. Like, I don't know. I just think it's the coolest shot in the movie.
That's great.
Did you hear the backup plan for the effects? So they had a guy with the scuba gear thing. And in case they ran into problems, Tom Savini had a sledgehammer. He's going to bash the aquarium. Oh, good. Okay.
Great.
Yeah. Sounds like a good, safe plan. Let's
good
get this.
Thing
Tom Savini always had a backup.
My job.
Always had a backup.
Also, rumor has it that Leslie Nielsen, before they would start filming, he had a little fart maker. And can't even say without cracking up. But right before he'd say, okay, action, he'd make a little fart noise. He would constantly be cracking up Ted Danson.
That's hilarious.
By the way, the end of the scene when Ted Danson and Becky come back, you know, zombified. First of all, they zombie up. They look
pruny.
Overly pruny, you know, for being in the water for 2 hours. And then he shoots them and like soy sauce comes out of their head.
It's just water.
They're also moving extremely slow. And you're going to tell me that they like dug a hole and chased him around and grabbed him and put him in there?
Well, but I mean, part of this is that they have the magic of being undead, because on all of the cameras, when it would show you the camera shot, they weren't in it. You didn't see them in the camera shot.
That's true. They're
like a ghost.
They're like a ghost.
Almost a Telltale Heart kind of thing, where is Leslie Nielsen really being attacked by zombies, or is it just his psychological breakdown?
Interesting.
Yeah. I can hold my breath a long time.
Or is Frank Drebin just having a terrible nightmare? Okay. We on to the next one?
Yeah.
The next one's called The Crate. This one's actually the longest segment at 40 minutes. They said that this was supposed to be number 3, but they pushed it to number 4 because they didn't want it to drag in the middle.
Yeah. Well, in my opinion, it batted cleanup. This is the best one of them all for me.
Okay. Okay. This stars Hal Holbrook, Adrian Barbeau, and Fluffy. Fluffy is the name that they gave the creature from The Crate.
Okay. All right.
I sent you guys a picture yesterday. You know, there's this creature who lives in a crate. They got him in the Arctic. I'm like, we've never seen a creature like this. Or have we? And I sent you a picture of the Bumble from the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer special.
Bumble's bounce!
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, they based it on a Yeti, so they nailed it.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was supposed to be from an Arctic expedition from June 19, 1834. And I looked that up and I was like, nothing happened on that day. Like literally, if you look up the date, the first thing that comes up is the Crate Wikipedia site. So that's the only event that happened that's of note, is that they put that on the crate. But what is interesting is right before this movie came out, Adrienne Barbeau had the sole female appearance in another movie that we've talked about that dealt with an Arctic expedition and a monster.
Yeah. You know
what it is?
I do.
Tell me.
It was The Thing.
Yeah.
And she played the voice of the computer.
That's right. She was the voice of the computer.
She was also married to John Carpenter at the time, I believe.
She was, yeah.
That's right.
The special effects were done by Rob Bottin, who also designed the skeleton crypt keeper at the beginning of Creepshow.
Oh, nice.
There you go. Adrienne Barbeau was also in this movie called Cannonball Run.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Starring Burt Reynolds. And we covered that season one.
We did.
You can go back and listen to that.
Versus Smokey and the Bandit.
You also have Hal Holbrook, though. I want to bring attention to him.
We had a great conversation about this. He's like, do you have any trivia on Hal Holbrook? And I was like, well, he's on the Golden Girls. And you're like, yeah, you told me that. I'm like, wait a minute. It was not the Golden Girls. It was the Southern Golden Girls. What is that show? And he was like, the Southern Golden Girls. I'm like, yeah, you know, it was like
designing women.
Yes. Is, you know,
Southern Golden Girls.
Four smart ass, slightly older than normal ladies giving it their best. I know it well enough to say that I watched the show and Hal Holbrook was a part of that show.
The way you just said that, slightly smarter than, or slightly older than normal ladies.
I didn't know what to say. Normal ladies in TV shows of the day.
Right.
Older than normal.
Middle-aged. Ladies. They were middle-aged. How about that?
I'm coming up on a golden age myself here. Yeah, so the age they were in that show.
Staring down the barrel of half a century.
I know. Happy birthday. Here you go. Hal Holbrook in 2008 at age 82 was the oldest actor ever nominated for an Academy Award. Okay. A little tidbit on Hal Holbrook. He was married to Dixie Carter.
He was in Designing Women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was his wife.
Okay.
How about that?
Nepotism comes right back up.
Never heard somebody banging the boss.
My friend, is the night the lights went out in Georgia. My favorite Dixie Carter line.
Okay, so you asked me what Hal Holbrook was nominated for an Academy Award for.
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know, some movie in 2007, one I probably don't care about or never heard of. Not true.
Right.
It's a movie called Into the Wild, and it's amazing.
We just talked about this again. We talked about Emile Hirsch. We talked about
Emile
Hirsch like a week ago.
That's right.
It's crazy how these things are coming up. And I'm not even kidding. Arlen, who's been a listener since day one, called me to talk about our best songs of 1994 as I was driving over here today.
Right.
And he brought up Emile Hirsch as well. I don't even know why. I don't know how he came up, but we're talking to Emile Hirsch and I'm like, hey buddy, I got to let you go. I'm about to go in and record on Creepshow versus Twilight Zone. And he's like, oh, I love both of those movies. I love both those movies. He's like, when you go in, say, tell him to call you Billy.
Call me Billy. Everyone else does. By the way, this is the one movie where Adrienne Barbeau's boobs could not pull her out of being a likable person.
Nope.
She's horrible in this movie.
Yep. And we've all known somebody like her. Actually, her performance in this, like as she's reading the letter, you gotta think, you have his voiceover and her reading this letter and kind of moving around in the kitchen as she reads the letter, and her delight and excitement at the misfortune of others is so palatable and so well done. I feel like she's an underrated actress. Maybe her boobs held her back somewhat.
And she celebrates in that delight with a glass of milk.
Yeah. You know, she starred in a movie in 1982 called Swamp Thing, which was very much like the death of Geordie Verrill.
That's true. Yeah.
There you go.
Her boobs were more prominent in that one.
That movie was rated PG.
I know.
Thank you.
Because I got to watch it.
Thank you.
It was like Airplane for you.
Exactly.
I'm watching, I'm like, oh, wow. I get this in a movie I'm allowed to watch. This is fantastic.
It's totally okay, Mom, because it's rated PG.
We can thank Poltergeist for PG-13. So rip a guy's face off.
Okay. Let's go on to the next one. The next segment is called They're Creeping Up on You. This stars Mr. E.G. Marshall.
I've got this bug problem. Once you get bugs, you never get rid of them. They breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
almost exclusively. This is like a one-man show. I mean, except for, you know, people on the intercom, on the telephone.
Right.
And then a one brief bit where he, and it's a greatly, it is very well done bit where he's talking to the maintenance man on the other side of the door. And they're talking through a little piece of glass that looks like it must be a magnifying glass. So as you move perspectives, you see their mouths enlarged to kind of gross graphic proportions as they're talking. But he does this whole thing basically by himself.
He's awesome in it.
It's really good. This is a guy who's in 12 Angry Men. This is a guy who played the president in Superman 2, and the lights aren't twinkling, Clark.
All right. Art from Christmas Vacation.
Thanks, Art.
No, and thanks for noticing. But he's a horrible person too, and his delight in other people's problems is he's gleeful.
Oh, it's terrible. You want him to die.
He's like, so your husband went out with a bang, eh? Yeah.
He could be best friends in a character we're going to talk about in Twilight Zone, that's for sure.
Yeah, so he's a horrible person. Obviously, this is based on Howard Hughes, who is a germaphobe, and he's got all these, you know, he starts to see bugs in his apartment. He's like, I'm paying $3,200 for the penthouse apartment. This is supposed to be germ-free, and how can it be germ-free if it's not even bug-free? He's got cockroaches. And I remember as a kid, on my way out to catch the school bus, I was watching Good Morning America with my mom, and they showed the preview for this. And it was like the weird guy with the big mustache on Good Morning America, and he showed a clip where cockroaches were taking over, and it was like going to kill, you know, killing this guy. And I was horrified as a little kid going to school.
So gross. And
I mean, this is super intense. It's gross and it's scary, and you can feel it coming.
So apparently they imported all the cockroaches from Trinidad.
Yeah.
Because if they would have purchased them in the States, they would have been like 50 cents a piece. So it was cheaper to bring them in from Trinidad. They brought in about 18,000 of them and then had a trailer on set where they bred the cockroaches because they needed so many of them. And there is article after article about how you cannot control a cockroach. Cockroach does not act. They had to cover the walls in Vaseline to keep them from climbing the walls.
Oh my gosh.
They did not recover nearly as many as they released on this set. They were all over the place. They would pick up the phone. They'd hear them in the handsets and the offices. And I mean,
I would burn that place to the ground.
Right. I mean, but cockroaches, nuclear war, you know, I mean, they're going to survive that too. The whole segment grosses me out so bad.
Laugh at your Vaseline attempts to keep us
right. And originally they wanted the set. Romero wanted the set to be a fully carpeted apartment, but they knew that wasn't going to work for the cockroaches either, which I think is a good call. Cause if he was a germaphobes to that degree, aren't going to have carpeting.
Yeah. The stark white of everything in the apartment, in the penthouse apartment, is a great effect. And I think that it is accentuated by the fact that they have that one old school jukebox just in the middle of it. Like, it's not like he's really enjoying the music that much, but for some reason, having that thing right there makes it more real than if he was in a completely sanitary, sterile environment.
Right. That'd be the one prop I want from this movie. That jukebox is amazing.
It is pretty cool. Full of cockroaches now.
By the way... By the way, so the end scene where he, of course, is consumed by the cockroaches, there's this incredible effect where, like, his neck opens up and all these cockroaches come pouring out. And I wondered, like, how did they get that effect? Well, I guess Tom Savini had, like, this giant fat syringe full of cockroaches, and he just pushed the little plunger, and they just all went out of the guy's neck.
Well, I mean, and as the scene went on, it became very obvious that he had a dummy. It was no longer E.G. Marshall's body there, right? As that scene began and he was actually dying, there's a moment where, like, his forehead swells up and it's still him. Like, it's still his head. It's the actor's head. And I see it swell up as though the cockroach is moving under his skin. And I'm like, that's the best effect in this whole dang movie. That was incredible. I don't know
practical
how they did
effects.
It.
Practical effects.
Amen, sister.
Heck yeah.
I miss those days, man, because CGI gets outdated tomorrow. None of these effects look outdated to me.
Looks like the video for Black Hole Sun.
That's right. Okay. And then we get the epilogue afterwards, right? This is when little Joe Hill has got a voodoo doll that he's sticking it to his dad finally.
Well, they totally bait you with that, right? They give the foreshadowing because the garbage men who find the comic book, they're like, oh, you can, you know, do this Joe Atlas thing, or you can do this, you can get these x-ray glasses. No, those don't actually work. Oh, you can order a voodoo wall. Well, it looks like somebody already ordered the voodoo
that
wall.
Was cool, right?
Ah, wink, nudge.
Yep. And once again, those garbage men, one of those guys is Tom Savini, the makeup effects guy for Creepshow.
Yep.
And then
I love it that he has little cameos in a lot of movies he does. Because, you know, he was in Dawn of the Dead as well as one of the bikers and stuff. I just love having that little rough edge that he has. So a pleasant surprise, because I forgot about him being a garbage man until I saw it again. So
nice. Okay, so that pretty much wraps up Creepshow. I do have a couple of little nuggets I want to drop on you. They originally were going to release this for Halloween. They didn't release it until like November 10th, 11th, something like that, 1982, because they were scared off because Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, was coming out.
For our listening audience, our guest host today, Amanda Janik, is wearing a Halloween 2 t-shirt right now.
My favorite one.
Halloween 3 is the one with that crazy song that still haunts my dreams. But they were scared off because they thought that was going to be the big hit, right? And it turned out people didn't really like not having Michael Myers in a Halloween movie.
Turns out,
right?
Season of the Witch can go suck an egg.
It's having its resurgence. Don't kid yourself.
Oh, by the way, Season of the Witch. Did we mention the fact
that Tom Atkins is in? Yeah.
Okay.
Tom Atkins, big player in Season of the Witch.
Yep.
But they moved it back to November 12th, which is typically holiday, kids, you know, Snoopy and Thanksgiving and all that stuff. And so you have kind of a creepy, scary movie in mid-November. Also, I thought this was cool. For good luck, throughout the filming of Creepshow, Stephen King kept a Star Wars action figure of Greedo in his pocket.
That's a weird character to choose.
It is weird.
That is strange.
It is weird.
On shot first. So I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm like, these sound like terrible ideas. This was the highest grossing Warner Brothers horror movie of the year. And second weekend, it knocked First Blood out of the top spot.
Wow.
That is no small achievement.
Okay, so that's going to do it for this first episode of Creepshow versus Twilight Zone. Amanda, thank you for coming on. You coming back next week to do part two with us?
You bet. I can't wait.
All right. Awesome. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.